just go directly to the 8th Circle. It's the Rick Emerson Show live from Portland. It's 503-733-2970. 503-733-2970. Still to come, Dennis Pitchenbarger, top 5, Tom Likas at 3, Donna Mike at 7. Ladies and gentlemen, reporting live from West Blacksburg, Virginia, let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show, Lisa Goddard, CNN radio correspondent to the stars. Hi, Lisa. How you doing?
Hey, Rick. How are you guys?
Well, you know, it's all relative, I suppose. I hate to just be so grim right out of the gate here, but because this story shifts so frequently, is it...
Right.
Just so I can get a handle on this, are we talking about, it was, what, 63 people shot, 33 of them dead? Is that right?
Yeah, we've got that. I think that is right. But the shots, it's true. We've got changing numbers on how many people were shot because some people were released sooner than others. I think there's still 17 people in the hospital. What's amazing is I think some 20 at least of those who were injured, all of them had at least 3 bullet wounds. So then, if you're counting bullets, I mean, we're talking about well over 100 bullets, maybe many more, that this shooter fired.
What kind of, to the best of our knowledge, what kind of weaponry are we talking about? I heard it was handguns, but again, I realize that about half of what I hear is probably wrong at this point.
No, actually it was handguns. That is correct. There were two. One was a Glock 9mm, the other was a 22mm. And now that Glock is the gun that is connected to both the first shooting, in which the two students were killed in the dorm, and then also that same gun was used at Norris Hall, which is the classroom building where all the other deaths happened.
Did this guy have any record, to the best of our knowledge, or was this, I mean, they said he was sort of a brooding, bitter loner type, but I mean, he wasn't a criminal before this, was he?
Not that we know of. We've interviewed the man who sold him one of those guns, and we know that there was a background check that was done on him, but it was, you know, just your classic 60-second background check, and apparently nothing came up on that. We are getting more, that's really where this story is right now, is getting more information about this shooter, and it depends on how you want to pronounce the name. His last name is Cho, his first name, Sung Hui. On campus, he went by Sung Hui Cho. In Korean culture, he puts the last name first. Anyway, we're hearing now from classmates, we've now seen on the internet excerpts from a one-act play that he wrote, which was very violent, and I've got to say very juvenile, too. Very, very strangely written play, but clearly violent, clearly angry tones in it. Also, we're hearing from a professor of his that says she was so concerned about him in class that she made the move to have a solo class with him, that she notified others in her department, and she recommended that he get counseling. She described him as someone who wore sunglasses to class every day. He didn't always respond when he was asked a direct question, sometimes pausing 20, 30 seconds before responding. Now, I know the area he grew up in. He came to America when he was 8 years old in 1992. He grew up in Northern Virginia, not far from where I grew up, in a town called Centerville, and also went to high school near Chantilly. They're all Northern Virginia suburbs, and it's really fascinating. His sister went to Princeton. His family is described as very hardworking, mother and father who work apparently in the dry cleaning business. And, you know, it's just hard to say what exactly led to this, but it is clear that people on campus saw these signs before.
And just to double back on this for a moment, is it,
right,
to the best of our knowledge, all the weapons that he used were all purchased legally?
We know that at least one was purchased legally. We don't know about the second one, but it is possible. He had his green card. He was a legal resident, though he wasn't an American citizen. He was a legal resident, and you can purchase a handgun with that status. So it is possible the other one was purchased legally as well.
And, of course, what I absolutely don't want to do is be another guy piling on with some nitwit snap judgment about this, because that sort of seems to be what members of the media, you know.
Yeah, I think that's right. I agree with you on that.
In my position, do I?
Well, not.
I guess what I'm saying, you know, and that's what all the idiot talking heads do is they immediately go, well, what I want to know is this, and they pound their fists angrily, and they start to make assertions from the very beginning without having even a smattering of the facts. And so I don't want to do that, but I do want to ask this, which is, has the school itself volunteered any information about why the non-notification during this two-hour lag between the two shootings?
Yeah, this is what they've told us. They said the first shooting, when they got to the scene, I guess from interviews with people there, they developed this person of interest, that ostensibly a suspect, but, you know, person of interest is sort of one degree down. And they actually went out, found this person of interest, and were interviewing them. Now, they haven't said this, but they're implying that at the time they thought they had it all solved. They had this guy, but minutes after they found this person of interest, that's when the second shooting happened. So on the one hand, I think police made some assumptions about who caused that first shooting that may have been wrong, but we're still working on that. Then as to the emails, honestly, Rick, we haven't gotten a great explanation yet on the timeline there. We know what happened. We know that 1 hour after that first shooting, the university president and top administrators were meeting about what to do, but it took another hour after that to get out the campus-wide email. And, you know, I can imagine a scenario where, let's say that it was an isolated shooting, let's say that it just ended there, and I could see a campus patting themselves on the back, hey, we got word out within 2 hours.
Sure.
But I think that this event changes that. I think this event changes what campuses will look at as an appropriate timeline when there's violence on their campus.
Andrews, and I know you're very busy, so my final question before we go is there a standard procedure in place, because clearly there were 911 calls placed about this, is there a standard procedure that explains why the cops seemingly didn't go right in and just end this?
In North Hall?
Yeah.
Academic building?
There is sort of a perception, and again, maybe I'm wrong about this, but there is a perception that the cops, as they did at Columbine, sort of held back and maybe didn't go in as soon as you would think that they might.
I don't know of any standard procedure here that would affect that, but what we know about that situation is that police immediately approached the front doors, and those front doors were chained shut from the inside. And so it took them some time to go. I mean, it's a very long building, and to get to the other doors takes a few minutes, and there was also police officers at the front doors trying to break through with these chains. You know, they haven't said the gunman did it, but really, who else would have done that?
Well, because there's no accomplice or anything, to the best of our knowledge, right?
To the best of our knowledge, there isn't, but police, I think, are adding to confusion. Officials here are being very careful to say, we haven't ruled that out.
Right.
But I think that's just making students more, making them just confused. Why? Is there someone out there? But they don't seem to have any reason to believe that there is.
All right. Well, I'm sure that we'll be talking more about this as it unfolds in the future. Lisa, thanks so much. And I guess to whatever extent possible, I hope this resolves itself in terms of figuring out what happened and how. And again, just sort of so people can just at least start to kind of move forward, which is going to be impossible until some of these questions are answered. So, all right, Lisa, thank you so much. Lisa Goddard live in Virginia, ladies and gentlemen. CNN radio correspondent Lisa Goddard. All right, there you go. It's 503-733-2970. You can also email if you like. We'll pay a visit to the Ministry of Truth here in a second, and then we'll move on to a few other things, and we'll kind of update you on this throughout the day. Let's see. We've got, what have I got? I got a couple of these. Rick, it pisses me off when people start talking as if they're Monday morning quarterbacks. It's really easy to say what you would have done from the safety of your own home after some violent event takes place. You can't know what every person's reaction is going to be. You want to think you'd be a hero, but the truth is it becomes a matter of survival. You can't assume you'd do something in the moment of violence when you've never experienced anything like it before. You freeze, you go into shock, you see a person die in front of you. You can't quite process immediately what's happening, which is totally the idea. Well, if I had been there, I would have, you know, which is just ridiculous. On a lighter subject, we have this. Rick, I heard you talking about the Green Apron book. You're talking about the black book with the green apron on the cover, right? No, I am not, sir. Well, anyway, he says, my company helped make those, and they're limited in number. My boss says there are only 100 in existence. We have one of them, but I don't think I could borrow it to use. I don't know much else about the book, just that I believe some of these were made for corporate headquarters in Seattle. Thanks, Todd. Okay, now
I'm
confused.
No, because it was a green book that was like a passport.
This was exactly, the Green Apron book the Starbucks Green Apron book, as made famous in the Starbucks song, which we will play again here in just a few. The Green Apron book I found laying in the street by a Safeway in southeast Portland. And it was green, and it was paper, but it was made to look like the fabric of an apron. It was made to look as though it was made out of green apron fabric. Now I'm all confused and perplexed, though. Now I'm titillated and tantalized by this black book with a green apron on the cover. Now I want to know what that is. That sounds like some secret Starbucks book. But it's all fascinating. All right, let's pay a visit to your president, prophet, seer, and revelator.
And now, from the Ministry of Truth, this is Pim Riley.
Somebody has vandalized in a lower hole and painted graffiti all over it. And the guy's car, too. He said he doesn't have that much against graffiti, as long as it's kept in its proper place. But they spray-painted his SUV and his fence.
Where is this?
Aloha. Mm. That's a small town of 70s tract homes.
Right. Yes.
Have you heard half of which you use as methamphetamine labs? It's the gateway to Beaverton. The bad gate.
The bat gate. All right. The hell gate to Beaverton.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
And they apparently they cleared up that semi that was jacked up on the junction of I-5 southbound I-84. So that's.
Can I just tell you, I can never hear a story about a quote jackknifed semi without hearing that Alabama song in my head. Do you know the one I'm talking about? That Roll On song by Alabama.
Oh, Roll On, yeah.
Roll On, Mama, something truck or whatever that song is. Mm-hmm. And there's that line about the police had found jackknife semi or whatever. However, I don't even know what I'm saying. I'm just making it up now. I don't even know. But this is an observation that no one cares about. Let's move on.
Let's see what else do we have here. A woman has been arrested for shoplifting, and she's blamed her crime on irritable bowel syndrome. 61-year-old Helen Gallo of Clearwater, Florida, arrested after allegedly shoplifting at a grocery store. She told authorities she couldn't wait in line because she has irritable bowel syndrome. She's charged with petite larceny. Is that a new charge?
It's a cute little larceny. It's a charming, adorable little crime.
And her bail is $500. Meanwhile, Malawi police and stone-throwing hoodlums blocked journalists from covering Madonna's visit to an orphanage where the boy she is adopting was due to meet his biological father. Teenage students in black and yellow uniforms from the secondary school of Hope Orphanage hurled stones at journalist cars and formed a protective ring around the building. Nobody got to see Madonna. Seinfeld and Dancing with the Stars alumni John O'Herlihy, whoever he is.
John O'Herlihy. No, I don't know who that is.
Well, he's...
Wait. No.
He's the front runner to be the new Bob Barker.
John O'Herlihy?
Yeah.
Where do I know him from?
O'Herlihy? John O'Herlihy?
How do you spell it?
O, apostrophe, H-U-R-L-E-Y. O'Herlihy.
Oh, that's John O'Herlihy. Yeah, I don't know who that is.
Well, you might soon because he's going to be the new Bob Barker. At least they think he is. It's rumored that CBS will wait until the middle of next month to make an official announcement on who gets the job.
You know that guy. It's Peterman from Seinfeld.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I could see him doing that. He's Elaine's boss? Yeah, okay. I could see that.
You know, the other person in the running is George Hamilton.
Wait, hold on. Now, this always happens. George Hamilton. He's the tan one?
He's the tan one.
All right. There you go.
He's for the white man with a tan. Let's get that straight.
For the first time in my godless life, I've gotten it correct. I've not confused him with George Kennedy. All right. George, what does George Hamilton do? I mean, when he's not busy auditioning for the Bob Barker job. I mean, what has George Hamilton been in that I would even really know? Why do I even know
who he is? He was in those beach blanket movies with Annette Funicello.
Back in 1950?
62, 63?
I mean, what has he done since then?
Well, he doesn't have to do anything. People just watch these movies over and over again.
George Hamilton.
Yeah.
All right.
And George Kennedy is a separate actor.
George Kennedy is dead, though, I think.
I'm not going to put myself through that.
You know who's not dead? Mr. Wizard, alias Don Herbert, he is still alive. He's 90 years old. 90 years young.
Well, he won't be replacing Bob Barker.
No. No one will be replacing Mr. Wizard either. Okay. I think we're done for a while.
For now. I've got other fish to fry at the moment.
Okay.
Soy fish. I'll be back.
All right.
I'm not sure when.
Rick! Okay. What a strange little program we have here. Rick, you should have Scotty prepare a quick little laugh track to use whenever you're speaking to a new CNN correspondent. It's difficult for them to immediately catch your style of humor. Maybe you could use a laugh track as a social cue that you're trying to be funny. We should totally do that, like with Amanda Moyer. Like with Amanda Moyer? Moyer?
I barely knew her.
Oh, that's retarded. Okay,
that is so retarded.
We totally have to do that.
Okay.
We should test it on Lisa Goddard sometime when she's not covering the deaths of dozens of people. We should spring that on her. Just to see what she thinks about it. Rick, about Amanda Moyer. She sounds like she's about 15 years old, by the way. Maybe she was too young to understand you. Yeah, she didn't really seem to get my whatever. Hey, Rick, are you going to be doing that It's the Worst Story Ever? Yeah, we're going to do that maybe here, but
Maybe not. We'll do it before the show's over. He said, the worst story I ever heard on your show in the personal injury category was the roofer who was straddling a roof beam holding a nail gun and accidentally nailed his sack to the roof beam through his work pants. I don't even remember that.
I think the contaminated blood coming out of the sewer right into someone's mouth is the worst.
We're going to start with that one. Here's how we're going to do this. We're not going to necessarily do it every day. We're going to do it, I don't know, sporadically, whenever the mood strikes me. What we'll do is we will have two horrible stories, and then we will have an Insta-poll. The audience will vote on which is the worst of the two. And then that story will become, you know, the sort of the champion. And at the end of the year, we are going to have, we will crown something the worst story in the history of all humanity. So that blood in the sewer story, that is the story that we're going to, I don't know, sewer.
I barely knew her.
That's the...
I missed it. I was thinking about
I barely knew her.
Anywho, that will be the one we start with.
Our jobs are weird.
It's true. All right, it's 503-733-2970. 503-733-2970. Steve, you're on the Rick Emerson Show. What up?
Hey, Rick, what's up?
What do you got, brother?
Best show. I mean, by best, I mean most morbid show ever.
Thank you.
Yes, the John O'Hurley guy. I'm pretty sure he's the current host of Family Feud.
All right. Really? Is that true? I'm looking at him right now. Yeah, Susan mm-hmm. Reynolds verified it.
It's really spooky eyebrows.
He's
kind of handsome in a strange way.
Oh, no, he's a good-looking man. Yeah. I can see that. He's got big black eyebrows and gray hair.
He totally looks like George Hamilton.
I could see him hosting Price is Right.
So could I.
What's going on in the background, friend?
Oh, my dog's yelling at the door.
Is he barking at evil?
No. Okay. It's moderately evil.
Okay. all right. Thank you, sir.
Hey, take it easy.
That's Steve. All right. There you go. Or as my friend Todd used to say, take her easy. She's easy. Take her twice. Oh, thank you, Amanda. All right. So I can totally see this guy doing Price Right. He's got that sort of hint of irony to him. I can see.
He does speak kind of like Will Ferrell does on Anchorman.
He does. And he is one of those guys... he is one of those guys that you're not entirely sure if he's always in character. You're not entirely sure when you see him interviewed. Like, I don't know if I've ever really seen him speak as himself. Because even when he's not on Seinfeld, he always kind of seems to talk in that self-important kind of way.
Like Megan Mullally, that's just weird when you see her talking because you're used to her speaking in the high-pitched voice.
Totally, exactly. Or that woman who played Mimi on Drew Carey is the same way. So, all right. Well, he could do that. You know, truth be told, I don't really care. I don't really care who replaces Bob Barker. I'm not a stoned college student or Aaron, so I haven't watched that show in like 20 years. Rick? About the roofer, I vote that one is the worst story for men that are driving. The cringing almost caused an accident. See, I don't even remember the story about the guy nailing his sack to the roof with a nail gun. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm sure it did.
I do.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I guess we've had so many stories that involve guys inadvertently putting nails through their body with a nail gun, or inadvertently pounding their sack with something, or inadvertently piercing their body or cutting off their scrotum. I mean, it's like we've had... They all drift together. So, all right. Rick, about George Hamilton, he was in Love at First Bite, the god-awful Dracula comedy. I think he's a closet case. Richard Simmons' generation. My mom had a crush on him for some reason. All right. Love at First Bite, was that the one with Jim Carrey?
Oh,
no, that's
my God.
That's Once Bitten.
Are you sure?
Yeah, Once Bitten is the one with Jim Carrey.
Yeah, I remember. I've seen that
movie. I can't be a vampire. I'm a day person, he says. That's Once Bitten. I don't know what Love at First Bite is. Maybe I didn't see that.
Who was the female vampire in that?
In Once Bitten?
Uh-huh.
It was, oh, God, don't tell me. Once Bitten had Jim Carrey. It had Clea Von Little from Blazing Saddles. He was Sheriff Bart in Blazing Saddles, and he played a very effeminate gay black man mm-hmm. in Once Bitten. Who was the woman? It was like some Shannon Tweed type, like a... What do they call it now? What do they call those women now? They're not MILFs anymore. They're called cougars.
Yeah, the elderly.
Cougar?
I barely knew her.
Lauren Hutton.
Lauren Hutton, that's right. Boy, she was hot. She's probably dead now. All right. It's 503-733-2970. Rick and Sarah, this email says... I wanted to let you know how far your word is spread. We, the Muddy River Nightmare Band...
Ooh.
When I do that, we talk about Blazing Saddles. We, the God-fearing white people of Rock Ridge, We, the Muddy River Nightmare Band, got back a week and a half ago from a two-week tour of Tokyo, Japan.
Really?
The Muddy River Nightmare Band tours Tokyo? I'm not saying...
Awesome.
I mean, no, it's very cool. I'm just saying, you must have frightened those people. I mean, really. I mean, it's... You're a scary-looking bunch of dudes. They are. Does anybody in any foreign country... It has nothing to do with Japan. Anybody in any country who's not expecting you people, and by you people, I mean you and the Muddy River Nightmare Band, you would frighten anyone anywhere. Well, whatever. Anyway, at one of the shows, the only one we actually got paid for, a guy shows up and said he'd heard of us because of the Rick Emerson show. In Tokyo?
What?
He said he was looking in one of the local Tokyo papers to find something to do, saw our name, and knew who we were because of you. I guess he was visiting his son who goes to school in Tokyo, so they both came and we had a great time. He said his name was Dave from the Couve. Thanks to Dave, and thanks again, you have now stretched across the Pacific to the land of the rising sun. I'll be there on Thursday, but I will be there. I'll send you some pictures when I get them organized. That's at Brent.
I'll be late.
So, apparently, the Muddy River Nightmare Band was playing a show in Tokyo, and some guys there knew who they were because of us. Well, that's just weird.
That's pretty cool.
Totally. It's just bizarre, though.
It was like when I went to visit, when I was in London, I went to visit MXPX, who are from my hometown of Bremerton, in London.
That's bizarre.
It feels very surreal.
All right, it's 503-733-2. I went to New York one time, and I walked into a guy that lived about a block from me. It's the strangest thing. It's in New York City, walking around, like where Times Square, walked right by a guy who lived, like, across the street from me.
Me too, same thing. Last time I was in New York, a girl I went to college with. Are we just going to go back and forth here?
Now, that'll freak you out, though.
Yeah, it was bizarre.
That'll freak you out. That'll make you think twice about doing something you shouldn't be doing, because you realize that, like, if you try it, that you'll turn the corner, and you'll run into, like, whatever. You'll run into, like, your boss or something. Mike, you're on the Rick Emerson Show. Hi.
Rick. I believe it was in the 70s. George Hamilton, he was in the movie Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh, so, right. Okay. What did he...
There was a little sexual reference there about him not being able to...
No, you're thinking of... you're thinking of Warren Beatty.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I am. I'm sorry. I apologize.
You couldn't possibly be more wrong.
Yeah, no, you're right.
All right, yes, I am, sir. Thank you.
All right,
there you go. Feel shame. No. All right, 503-733-2. We should be done.
Yeah,
we need to break here.
Yes.
Come back. We come back. We'll vote on the worst story ever. Dennis Pitzenbarger will join us. We'll do the top five as well. Like is at 3. Donna, Mike at 7. You say there's the Rick Emerson Show. 503-733-2970. Don't go anywhere. The Rick Emerson Show continues after this.